Hello, everybody, and welcome to the U.S. Institute of Peace today for another session of our Afghanistan Working Group. I am really thrilled to have, I think, three fascinating speakers, all of whom are not necessarily the usual ones on the circuit here, so I think we will hear some interesting and different insights to what we often get. Today's panel is on a subject which has been, I think, a really important and disturbing one for all of us, even those of us who have supported the Afghan intervention from the beginning have been dismayed at the physical cost of lives. Of course, not only the lives of our own soldiers and civilians, but particularly the lives of Afghans who have been through an incredible and horrible 30 years already, and at the point of their liberation, if that's what this is about, are still experiencing a tremendous amount of pressure that comes with the country being at war. I don't have or track the statistics, but and maybe some of our speakers will talk about this, but I think that there's no doubt that thousands of Afghan lives, innocent civilian lives, have been lost in the conflict. And I think that this is a critical issue for NATO and the United States in two respects. It's clearly a critical issue because the loss of innocent civilian life should be minimized at great cost. But it is also a strategic issue. As the intervention in Afghanistan drags on, we are now into our seventh year of intervention there. The presence of international military forces, some say, probably rightly, is not without, or the patience for those forces is not without an end within Afghanistan. And the extent to which those military forces are seen to be taking innocent civilian lives, perhaps unnecessarily, and that I think is something that we'll discuss today, is obviously impacts very heavily on the extent to which Afghans will continue to support the mission there. So in order to talk about this, we have three speakers, and I'm going to introduce them, and then they will speak each for about 10 or 15 minutes, and then we will have plenty of time for question and answer. Our first speaker today is Elizabeth Rubin, and if not known to you in person, Elizabeth's work is undoubtedly known to most of you for her long career of writing, and particularly for the last few years of the incredible reporting that she's done for the New York Times Magazine. In particular, and I think we have copies of it outside, Elizabeth had an article, not yesterday, but the Sunday prior. It was the cover article of the magazine called Battle Company is Out There, and she'll explain the title of that piece to us, if she can. That was just a joke, because it's a little bit confusing. But she has spent an enormous amount of time in Afghanistan, and particularly for this piece, spent an enormous amount of time, and if you've read the article, she spent a lot of time not in the comfortable hotels and guest houses where most of us on our trips spend in Afghanistan, but out in the field in extremely trying circumstances. And I just want to read from yesterday's Sunday Times. There were a series of letters about the article, and one quote which really summed up, I think, something that I thought when reading it. "This is one of the finest pieces of war reporting I have ever read. Not only does Elizabeth Rubin take us up close to the horrors of fighting and insurgency, but she manages to expose the moral dilemmas men like Captain Kearney," who's one of the focuses of the article, "face, and the inevitable moral contradictions that arise in that environment." Our second speaker is somebody who I also admire greatly for his bravery, and that is Mr. Nader Nadiri. Nader is an Afghan, and he has been a commissioner for the Afghan Independent Human Rights Commission since its inception. Perhaps needless to say, the position of being on the Afghan Independent Human Rights Commission is one that comes with some plaudits, but great risks. And Nader, as the person who has been the focus in particular for transitional justice, in other words, trying to deal with the abuses of the past, which of course implicates many people who are currently in the government, and also the focal point for the issue of civilian casualties and dealing with NATO. Nader has, at great risk to himself and his family, been an incredible asset for Afghanistan and the international community in the work that he's done. And he's going to talk about us. He's going to talk today, particularly about his experiences in dealing with the civilian casualty issue, and dealing with the international community. And finally, we have Mark Galasko, who hopefully some of you have read. I also think it's out there. A very interesting profile that was done on Mark in the Washington Post recently. One of the incredibly valuable things about Mark, who is now at Human Rights Watch, and will have a report coming out soon precisely on this issue, is that Mark was actually in the position of people who he was once reporting on. In other words, he has incredible inside knowledge and technical expertise as to what a targeter does, how they do their job, what sorts of information sources they have to rely upon, and ultimately trying to make decisions in the heat of battle about what the right thing to do is. And I think it's an incredibly difficult position to be in, and an equally difficult position to have moved over to the human rights community to do the brave kind of reporting that Mark does, bringing that inside view to all of us. So without anything further, we will start with Elizabeth.
Thanks so much, Alex. First, I'm just going to tell you a little bit. Do you need this, or can you hear without it? Is this on?
We need it for recording purposes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I went on this trip to Afghanistan, which was in September of last year. It was about my fifth trip since September 11th. I had been going for many years, always ending up in the hospital in Kandahar, where, in fact, the first time was, I think, July 2002. There had been an airstrike in Uruzgan in the south, and that was basically mistaken intelligence. At the time, the special forces who were conducting a ground operation said that they went in there and there was wedding party fire, you know, happy fire for a celebration. And this was their excuse for why these airstrikes were dropped by accident. And what happened were close to, Nader probably remembers the number, but close to 40 or 50 civilians were killed.
47.
Excuse me?
47.
And up to 100 were injured. And the hospital was filling up with casualties. There was a young girl there whose brother was killed. He was the bridegroom. And her mother and father, her whole family was killed. And she said to me, I was trying to find out from her exactly what had happened. She said, you know, why do the Americans always make these mistakes and then come and ask us stupid questions after? She was about 12. And obviously in shock and injured. But it stuck with me every time I went back there. And I always went back to that hospital, and the civilian casualties continued. And every time there was another mistaken air assault, either by helicopters or airplanes, but it started to get more complicated. By 2006, the Taliban were using villagers' homes, to fire rockets from the rooftops at helicopters or at NATO troops. And oftentimes there was a confusion in battle, and whether it was Canadians or Americans, they would drop bombs on the houses. Inevitably, there were civilians inside. And so that sort of what initially started out as intelligence errors, where a group of special forces would have become friends with one tribe or one guy, one commander, and he would sort of give them good information one time, they would arrest somebody, and they believed everything he said after that. And so he might use them for a local rivalry. That started to change as the Taliban got smarter and understood the media power of NATO killing civilians. And so in some ways, they actually brought it on. So on this trip, I decided to just go and see what the military perspective was on this issue and how they were making decisions, if they were making decisions, you know, was it as random as it seemed to us when the numbers were so huge? And so I went to embed with a group in eastern Afghanistan in Kunar, out in a place called the Korangal Valley, which is not, it's a bit unusual for Afghanistan. It's a small tribe of displaced people from another province, and they practice Wahhabism, which most Afghans do not. They are kind of ostracized from the rest of Afghanistan, even from their neighbors. They have problems with them. They're very rich, though, with from the timber trade. There's no drugs there, but there's smuggling of timber. And for the last few years, the Americans set up a base there in April of 2006. Before that, the Marines would just go in sometimes and go in and sort of make incursions in there, thinking oftentimes, as this also had started, with bad intelligence. They went after people who they thought were Taliban and got the entire valley against the Americans. So I went and embedded with one company that's way out in the mountains, very small little bases. You know, there's probably 20 to 40 people maximum on the base. There's no real protection but barbed wire and a few sentries looking out. They live in tents or in bunkers. They do patrols into the villages. And they have been they've been out there, I would say, now since May of last year, this particular group. And they have almost no real interaction with the Afghans of that area. It's not like when you go down 15 minutes to another valley, you have kids playing soccer on the base, you have Afghan police that you can hang out with and talk to. Even if they're lying to you, at least there's some, you know, interaction, and there are people who are on the side of the Americans. Up here, it's completely different. Basically, this group of people wants the Americans to leave. And the elders there are caught between the insurgents and the Americans. They get sort of hit by both sides, and so they play both sides. The night before I arrived, I was in the battalion headquarters, which is a mildly bigger base in what's called the Pech Valley in Kunar, if anybody knows the region. And they have now, you know, it's everything is on video screens. The technology is just like in the movies. There are predator drones flying over the valley, feeding down camera, you know, infrared images to the battalion headquarters. At the same time, you've got always in the air, you have either an A-10, which is these are all these jets, A-10s, B-1 bombers, the F-15s, flying overhead, also sending, some of them have cameras to send back images. And so that particular night, they had an infrared image of a mortar being fired from the roof of a house. And the captain from this company knew this village as a place that was primarily anti-American and primarily, insurgents could stay there with impunity. So I was with the colonel of the battalion who was watching the mortar firing at his men, and they needed to get two forms of basically identification in order to be able to launch an airstrike. And this is what they called positive identification. So they had the image of the mortar firing, and then they had people on the ground who were under attack. And then they did an assessment of the collateral damage, what would happen if they dropped this bomb on the house. They called up the captain to find out how many houses are in the area. And it all sounds very exact, but of course it's not. Nobody has any idea how many people are inside the house. You don't know how far. I mean, Mark will talk much more about this, but they say they know how far the shrapnel is going to fly. But who knows? So in any case, the decision was made. They're firing on us. We know this is a mortar. We're dropping the bomb. They dropped the bomb. The next morning, I'm up in the valley where this was dropped, but on the base of the Americans, and these kids are brought up to the base. And they have scratch marks all over their face. One of their eyes is all red. There's some women who are brought up, but the men won't let the women be seen by the doctors because they're male doctors. And nobody has any idea if actually these people were injured by the bomb or not. And it seemed pretty clear to me and the photographer I'm with that these are, you know, casualties from a bombing. But the military was not sure. And so it doesn't get reported as civilian casualties. And also then there becomes a problem with compensation because they don't have any absolute evidence. On the other hand, what did come out from a meeting with an elder there is that the house belonged to a Taliban commander. There were casualties inside, and they belonged to his family. So his wife was injured, his son was killed, his daughter-in-law was injured, and some of his grandchildren. And so you ask, well, why in the world would a guy allow somebody to fire a mortar from his house? And this is the kind of thing that this particular unit was dealing with. I went out on a 6-day mission with them that unfortunately we don't have time for me to get into the details of, but you can read it out there, in which these guys were making these decisions every single day. The captain of this company was faced on the first day of the mission with his soldiers landing in a village and him having intelligence that insurgents were going to attack them. He has air assets up in the sky so that he can attack the insurgents. But he also knows he's going to kill civilians. And this went on. I was with them about 2 months. I would say 3 times a week they were having to make these decisions. And they were not, you know, randomly dropping bombs. Possibly they were using too much ordnance, and the main reason that I felt and that they agreed was that they don't have enough troops out there. They're covering an area that's vast. The insurgents hide in caves behind boulders, and the boulders there are like the size of this room. And so it becomes, it's a basically like a supportive, you know, another unit going out to help the troops who are getting ambushed. And that's why air power is used so much more in Afghanistan than in Iraq, for example. And I would say that since June of last year, NATO has gotten a lot more careful about executing airstrikes. Again, Nader will probably have much more to say about this. And but again, in this particular region, I would say every other day they were dropping. There were airstrikes, and there were some weeks when probably 10,000, not weeks, hang on, let's, one bomb is 500 pounds. They could drop about 2,000. There was one day when they dropped about 5,000 pounds of bombs in a little area. And you can imagine what has happened to the villagers who live in this area. There's not a family now who has any ability to side with the Americans or the government, because they've just, you know, they've all lost somebody. And so what ends up happening is you're fighting a counterinsurgency where you're trying to win over these villagers, and you're dropping bombs on the insurgents. So the soldiers felt as frustrated as I, you know, asking questions as an observer. The soldiers understood that there was no way for them particularly to win this valley. When I asked them, what do you think you're accomplishing here? Most of them basically felt that they were not accomplishing anything and didn't think that they should stay in the valley. This is not something you'll hear about, you know, in most parts of Afghanistan. But there, they believed that they should leave and let the villagers run this area, because they're just killing too many people and they're getting too many people killed. And on that very happy note, I'm going to pass it to the mic. And then you can take questions.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Stories like that makes almost sense, especially in the 2000, starting with 2005, then to move into 2006 with the sharp increase into the number of insurgency in 2007, mostly makes most of our time during the year.
Yeah.
In particular, in 2007, when the number of civilian casualties has increased so highly, however, all of them not as a result of this air operations. We investigated and registered around 1,500 civilian who lost their lives during 2007. It's a big number in compared to the rest of the last 5-6 years. There are three main concerns that comes out of these practices, either by the international forces. We used to call them both parties of the conflict, those who are involved in the conflict, and then both the international community and Afghan government came and said, well, you know what, you can't call parties of the conflict. We defined it as an internal armed conflict, and according to common Article 3 of the Geneva Convention, it's not, the internationals cannot be called as party of the conflict. So we said pro-government forces and anti-government forces or insurgencies. So this 1,500 are a result of air operations, shooting on the roadsides by the international forces and the Afghan military forces during the operations. But at the same time, almost equal portion of this 1,500 people goes to the Taliban insurgencies and their tactics, either terrorizing people, killing elders, mullahs and religious leaders, and at the same time having suicide bombing in those areas where there's mostly civilian population. However, according to our data, some 75% of those targets, suicide bombing targets, the Taliban has conducted aimed to the military targets. But they were always targeted military in a very populated area where the civilians were like normal civilian activities. Cases like soldiers distributing ties and notebooks and pencils to children, and a suicide bomb attack that military target that killed children a lot. Or a suicide bomber targets a bus of the police officers going in the morning to their offices. Around 40 people in one bus was killed, but it was conducted in a very public, in a very populated, civilian populated area within the market, and killed more than, almost double than the police officers. So the main concerns are the suicide attacks, the air operations, and the abuses. One of the main issues that brings people against the international community and international forces is the abuses of or disrespect of the cultural issues, or not being sensitive to the cultural issues. As Elizabeth mentioned, the number of air operations has decreased. What we are witnessing, we were continuously calling for decrease of air operations. Because in most of those areas where we were investigating after air strike, we were seeing that the large number of civilian casualties killed, which in no way was proportionate to the number of the Taliban's casualty. And Taliban was using it in a very sophisticated way. They were trying to make human shields of, and they are still trying to make human shields of the civilians. Hiding in the villages where the population certainly didn't want them to be there, but they were forcing. We've seen patterns that the Taliban were forcing and intimidating people and entering into their compound and in their villages, just because, as Elizabeth mentioned, they know how profound impact that civilian casualty would have on the public, national, international public opinion, and they were the one. Journalists were telling me that whenever there is an airstrike, the Taliban spokesperson is the first to give them a call and say, give them an exaggerated number. On contrary, NATO or the coalition forces has to wait to verify, and it takes time. Or us, we have to first get the security assessment and to go, and when we are deployed there, it takes time. But the Taliban are giving. The government never responds. The spokesperson of the president or whatever, his cell phone is, or his number is not responding at all. So they are winning in that term using these air operations. We are continuously calling for a decrease in number of air operations, an increase in the number of ground troops. Whenever we talked to the military, both Afghan and internationals, they were telling us that the number that they have does not allow them to move to a village on ground operation. So they have no other option. They have to call air strike to either protect themselves when they are under attack or to get a target based on information that they receive. In 2006, there was a large number of air operations that were conducted based on false information. That is, fortunately, to a large extent now addressed. In 2007, we see a very limited number of those kind of targets. In 2007, I would bring a story as well from very remote village in Oruzgan, Chora district, where the Taliban was grouping at the outstrike of the villages before coming to the district. The Dutch troops who were based there, they run an operation there, send a message to the elders that they should evacuate the village. But the time between the message that was received by the villagers and the elders and the air operation was so short, so there was no time to really evacuate the village. The air operation was conducted. There was civilian casualties, around 40 again, in that village, plus injuries. The next days when we went there to meet with the people and conduct an investigation, to our surprise, we found villagers and the elders coming together. While they, some of them were direct victims, their properties were destroyed because of the bombing. In one voice, they were saying that they want these troops to be in this village, but not in the small number, but to increase their number here. And I was amazed that why they would ask this way, because my feeling was that they would say, well, we want them out. And the other side of the story that made them to ask this was the Taliban cut hands of two women who was not allowing their son, her son, to let Taliban coming into their compound or the village. In one incident, the Taliban, because a woman and two men in one house, they were resisting against the Taliban, they put burned them alive in that village. So those things were making the community to ask the international forces to stay there. But at the same time, they were complaining. They were saying, while you had the information, while you had the satellite images, while you had all the information that the Taliban are regrouping outside the village, why you did not hit them there before they enter into the village? And this was one of the biggest anger that we were witnessing there. On the question of winning hearts and minds, and not only these civilian casualty effects, but the question of not being sensitive to the cultural issues. However, in compared to 2004, 5, and 6, it's to a large number that the practices has changed in terms of searches, entering to the women compound, but still to the large number of complaints that we receive on the ground when people are very upset. Is that right overnight, using excessive ways like exploding a door and entering to the compound to gain access to a house without having proper information if it's children and women sleeping in that compound, and then searching a woman. Those still remain as a concern and still bring some issues of anger at the part of communities. In terms of now access of the organizations like us, AIH, and Independent Human Rights Commission, to the information that the military may provide to us, there's a good number of progress in that direction. In the past, there was no way to get a military officer to comment on an incident that has happened. We were there, we were talking to them, they were saying, oh, we are not there. This on this incident, it was not us. So we were going to coalition forces and then the NATO, and then they were blaming both the special forces, and then to get the special forces to comment, none of them were commenting. But recently, especially in the last 4 or 5 months, there's a good level of cooperation between the Commission and the, both the coalition forces, the Joint Command Task Force, and the NATO. They've introduced focal points, and in case of any incident, we get easy access to the focal point, and however, they do not provide information and comments immediately, but they promise and they get back to us, and we establish a kind of regular monthly meeting with them to share information, to meet with them, and they are now very much listening. And the main reason behind this is not only international pressure, public opinion pressure, but at the same time they know now that, because if they come out and say that the figures given by the Taliban are exaggerated, people do not trust, because they say it's just a kind of propaganda. And because we go and we properly do investigation, and sometimes, of course, the numbers are exaggerated, sometimes it's very difficult for the community to understand what's the legitimate collateral damage, and it's very difficult for us as well to tell people it's the legitimate collateral damages. They would say, well, what do you mean by killing civilians is it's legitimate? But if we come and say that after an investigation that the number are not as much, and to explain the circumstances, people do understand, and especially when they see by themselves that the Taliban's and Taliban's use of force entering into their villages. I would end with that note that still majority of places like those elders in Chura district, they look forward. They're looking forward to the presence of international community. They see that if the forces are not there, they would either be to the mercies of those warlords that are ruling in close to those areas, or again to the Taliban. And certainly they don't want that.
Well, I've just completed a report on civilian casualties caused by airstrikes in Afghanistan from 2006 to 2007, and Human Rights Watch will be publishing it, God willing, in the next month or so. Approximately from 2006 to 2007, we see a tripling of civilian casualties from airstrikes. We also see an increase in the employment of aerial munitions from 2006. Oh, you're looking at, and I'm going to give you gross estimates off the top of my head, approximately 5,000 pounds of bombs going downrange every month up until the early spring in 2006. It goes up a little bit to about 20,000 pounds a month, stabilizes, and then June of 2006, when there's the real heavy attack against the forces of the Taliban by NATO, it spikes up to about 80,000 pounds, and it's stayed there ever since. It does range between 60 and 100, and in December of 2007, it topped out at 168,000 pounds. So there's a huge increase in the use of munitions. So I was sitting in my office early in the summer last year, looking at this spike in civilian casualties, looking at how airstrikes are increasing, and saying, hey, we need to go over there and we need to investigate. We need to find out what's going on and why civilians are being killed. There's a few things that you guys need to understand about what's going on there before we delve into these numbers and what they actually mean and what's really behind the deaths of civilians from airstrikes. The first thing is, what is a civilian? And how difficult it is at times to determine what a civilian is in a nation in which the civilian population is often armed, and after a strike it is difficult for people to go in and make an assessment. And that makes our numbers necessarily very conservative. It's very difficult for us to go in and use the numbers of AIHRC and UNAMA and other organizations that are on the ground and pick through that and really drill down to what we think are the minimal numbers for civilian casualties. It's important for us to be fairly conservative because of the difficulty in truly assessing what a civilian is. Certainly women and children are easy, because it's much more difficult when you're talking about men of fighting age. That said, it's also important to understand the different roles on the ground of the forces. You have NATO, and you also have OEF, Operation Enduring Freedom. These are two separate organizations on the ground. NATO right now is made up of the United States and over 30 other nations involved in combat on the ground. You're talking about air power, which is largely United States. Let's say 90, probably even more than 90% of the air power is U.S. You have six Dutch F-16s. You have a handful of British GR-1s. You have a French Mirage that shows up every now and then. I literally track every single airstrike that goes in Afghanistan every single day, every plane that drops ammunition, every bomb that goes in, so I can look at it and understand between the Mark 82, 83, 84 series, 500, 1,000, and 2,000-pound weapons, the GBU-39, which is a new 250-pound low collateral damage bomb, the GBU-51, which is a new 500-pound low collateral damage bomb, and some of the other things that they're doing now to employ low collateral munitions. And so things have really changed in Afghanistan, the things that they're using. Now, why are civilians being killed in airstrikes, and why have they been killed from 06 to 07 in an increase? There are two types of airstrikes that occur on the ground in the country. The first is the pre-planned airstrike. You have pre-planned airstrikes going on in Afghanistan every single day, every day. There has not been a single civilian casualty in a pre-planned airstrike that I can determine in the last 2 years. The collateral damage mitigation procedures that they use are quite effective. They're able to use weapons in such a way, in such an angle, depth, type, against targets at certain times of day, use positive identification of the targets, and actually look at them, and they are required to do a physical assessment of a pattern of life, what they call pattern of life assessment, for every planned strike, so that they understand whether or not civilians are in the area. So what's the problem? The problem is a tick. Troops in contact, TIC. Almost every single civilian that has been killed in airstrikes has been killed in a troops in contact engagement in 2006, 2007, and increasingly so in 2007, up until, let's say, late July into August, when things have again changed. Troops in contact occurs when you have a small number of forces on the ground, as we've heard time and again, basically bump into a large number of militants on the ground, whether they're Taliban, and let's also understand this is not a monolithic enemy. You have Taliban, you have Al-Qaeda forces, you have criminal elements. There's a lot of different folks on the ground with weapons right now shooting back and forth at people. You have a small number of forces and they'll bump into these guys and there'll be an exchange of fire, and oftentimes NATO or OEF forces will withdraw. Sometimes they'll call in airstrikes. When they call in airstrikes, oftentimes you find civilian casualties. It's because these low number of troops are basically bumping into these large number of guys who have embedded themselves in civilian villages, and now when the bombs hit target, you're going to encounter civilian casualties. It's important to understand what do I mean when I'm saying NATO and OEF. As I stated, NATO is U.S. and those other nations on a U.N. mandate mission in the country. OEF is the U.S. only force, and either small British and some others, operating out of Bagram on the counterterrorism mission, which is basically a manhunt against the terrorist elements in the country. There is a big problem on how they communicate with each other. I've had a number of foreign government services talk to me about how it's very frustrating when we, for example, are in Helmand province and we know everyone who lives in this village, we know everyone in these towns, and all of a sudden you have CIA or special forces show up and they think they know what's going on and they go into an area and never consult with us, never find out what's really going on, who really lives in this area. They get into some kind of entangled engagement on the ground. They've got 6 or 12 guys, and now all of a sudden they're engaging, you know, 50 to 100 militants, and they feel they have no choice but to call in an airstrike. And that leads invariably to civilian casualties, and then guess what? We, whatever force it is in Helmand, now have to deal with that in an area that perhaps we have turned pro-government, and now you've got it going the other way. And so civilian casualties, by and large, up until about August of 07, has been a situation of problems with troops in contact. Troops in contact is further exacerbated by the fact that the U.S. has different rules of engagement from NATO. And this is further complicated by the fact that a large number of NATO forces are actually U.S. forces. Now, let me explain that to you. It's kind of complicated, but I hope to do this in a manner that's understandable. and if I don't, please hit me back. On the offense, if I am an American soldier and Nader here is a British soldier, we have the same rules of engagement. We're in lockstep. On the defense, however, I resort to national level rules of engagement. If he is going to call it an airstrike as a British soldier under NATO jurisdiction, he has to actually be receiving fire. That's his requirement. As an American soldier, I have to perceive a threat. And the problem is perception of threat is very subjective. And so we see this perhaps not as the root cause, but as something that is confusing and problematic. And this differing of rules of engagement then leads to a situation in which I spoke to General Votel, who's running basically the 82nd Airborne out of Bagram and running this OEF fight, and talking about asking when does a preemptive strike when does a defensive strike become preemptive? And there's a real kind of mix there and a little bit of a dissonance. You know, when I see someone with a weapon and I'm going to strike him because I want to do a preemptive attack, I feel a threat, but in reality, who is he? What is he? Why is he there? And maybe that's not someone that needs to be killed. So there's a lot of things going on the ground there. Now, I will state clearly, in September, things changed. The air folks in the KAOC, Combined Air Operations Center, really started to make a lot of positive changes. About two-thirds of all bombs that are being dropped in the country now are low collateral damage bombs. So they've made a huge step forward with the types of munitions that I'm seeing going downrange. Beyond that, they are really, really stepping back from calling it an airstrike and a tick. Their general rule of thumb is to disengage if a small force encounters a larger force, although that's not always possible. But like Elizabeth said, it's not always clear where the reporting is. When are civilian casualties being taken or when are they occurring? And so the data that I'm seeing, I believe, is certainly incomplete. It's conservative, but the report we're putting out, hopefully in the next month, will paint a better picture for people. Our concern is we've seen a real increase in airstrikes over the winter, which is completely uncharacteristic for Afghanistan. You characteristically see a lull over the winter months. We've seen a huge spike right now. And the concern is with the oncoming fight in the spring, as we expect it to get really, really hot, will we see a return of civilian casualties from airstrikes, or will we see a continuation where their changes are going to have this positive effect? And so that's kind of our current concern, is the spring offensive and what that will bring. So I hope that helps paint a picture a little more technical, maybe, than you were expecting from Human Rights Watch, but at any rate, that's what I got.
Thanks for that fantastic overview, and we do have a microphone over here for questions. Unfortunately, because we're recording, we do ask people that they come to the microphone to ask questions. And while people are doing that or formulating questions, I'm just going to start with the first one. Mark cited this striking statistic that I think we all saw this year, which is that the NATO forces or the government forces, the pro-government forces, were roughly causing the same number of casualties as the Taliban. What I was wondering if you could all comment on is that, as with anything, this is an information war as well as an actual war. And I'm curious the extent to which, in your experiences, are people perceiving, one, that the Taliban are also equally culpable and therefore unpopular for causing civilian casualties. You mentioned this problem of the Taliban getting out there and saying that the casualties are this number, and then the government and the NATO forces either waiting too long or not commenting at all. So is there something that the pro-government forces should be doing much better on the information side to overcome some of the problems that are caused by the casualties that they cause? And that's to all of you or any of you.
Well, I mean, to some extent, what happens is that, in my experience, nobody really believes anyone. I mean, it's not like the villagers or people in Afghanistan are believing what the Taliban say, or that they're going to believe what the government says. people in that area know what's happened. And part of the problem is that while they may not support the Taliban, the government in the local areas have become so corrupt and so heinous that they don't support anybody. They were hoping maybe that the NATO troops would be some kind of buffer between the two of them, but now they're just another group of people who bomb them, you know? So it's sort of like they're looking around and there's nobody to support. So I guess nobody's fooled by the information war, to some extent, is what I would say.
Just to add on what Elizabeth said, of course the people who are in the village, they don't believe on either side's information. They have the reality, and there are cases when we went there, they took us to, our researchers were taken by the community elders to the graveyard, and they're showing that these are either, this is a woman, this is children, this was a man who never had a relation with Taliban, but sometimes they're frank. They say, yes, we had these two who were Taliban, and then we compare the notes and we say, well, there were 18 people died and there are 16 graves. Mm-hmm. And where the three others or two others? Then they say, well, the two were not belong to this village and they were armed and they were Taliban. And you know that that two was most probably a Taliban because he's not buried in that graveyard. But the effect of this news that comes on the local media is so huge to the perception and understanding of the local population, to the role that the international community is playing, and that increases the anger. And look at the number of the demonstration that was conducted, and rallies were conducted, some of them very violent in Jalalabad, in Herat, in different parts. And these were because the numbers were given by Taliban, the media focused on that, because the local media, that these almost 17 TV channels that are broadcasting throughout the country, and Radio Free Afghanistan and Radio BBC that they are doing in local languages and Voice of America, people mostly listen to them. And the incidents and the numbers, and some elders, as an example in Helmand, in Musakala, the elders themselves, nobody is able to verify if that person calling to the radio station is an elder, really elder, or a Talib, saying that there were 80 people died, they're all civilian, why they bombed us. And this gets and feeds into the anger and dissatisfaction. And I think there is really need for running another war of information, or war of the word, which we both the international community and the Afghan government is losing on that. There was a report a couple of months ago or a few months ago that by Sandless Institute. They were saying that 50% of the population are under control of Taliban. I don't buy it, but it is true that people mentally, they are afraid, and because of this information they are receiving, they're threatened, and the fear that they have is almost covering 50% of the population. And that's an important point.
Mm-hmm. I just want to follow up with you. Do you think, though, that the people would actually believe NATO if it was coming out with a counter number immediately? I mean, would they buy it?
That's a question that all the time we ask as well. But what we find through our discussion and talk, they say at least that gives the news media a chance when we talk with the media organization, because we were worried as well that this feeds and the fear among the population. So we were talking to media, but at the same time, when you do this reporting, you do some peace journalism as well, focus on some other stuff because people are so afraid. Then they were saying, if we have NATO's information, at least we present a balanced news. We say, this is that the number by NATO, this is number by Taliban, but we can't comment yet. But certainly if Human Rights Watch comes, or if we on the local, we come and we say that we investigated and this number, people do listen to that and more.
I agree with what you guys are saying, and not to repeat that, I just want to say the one thing that really aggravates me is the response I hear sometimes out of NATO or out of U.S.-only forces where it's really a moral equivalency kind of argument. It says, well, the Taliban are fighting out of civilian homes, you know, and that's makes it okay. And that's a problem I have. And it's good to see they make changes in their procedures, but to always blame the Taliban. And what all the problems that we've had with all with airstrikes, with ground forces, whatever it is where civilians are being killed, I think what's far more important than that is transitional justice. And if they would really enact some strong transitional justice in the country, get at the warlords issue, get at some of the things that have been just festering for a long time, I think a lot of these problems would not happen. That's just my own two cents.
Well, hopefully we'll have a follow-up on that. So please ask a question if you could say what your name is and do so.
Yes, Edwin McWilliams, formerly with the State Department. Question to Mark, first of all. Has there been any reporting of use of cluster munitions by any of the forces on the NATO side? And also, is there any concern of humanitarian consequences of the use of depleted uranium, especially in the early years of the conflict?
Right. For cluster munitions, that's a very easy answer. Not only has there been no reported use, but NATO and U.S. forces are not allowed to even have cluster munitions in theater. Now, U.S. forces in Iraq have them as part of the what's called UBL, Unit Basic Load, just because that's what your artillery, for example, will ship out with. They sit on the pallet. They don't use those. But in Afghanistan, they're not even allowed to have them in theater. They can't fly over Afghanistan with them. What's very interesting is they go to such lengths that when they plot, when they plan an airstrike, and one of the reasons why these planned airstrikes are very effective, they will actually plot the air path over unpopulated areas on the off chance the weapon will detach from the rails. And it does happen. It's rare. But just the off chance it'll detach from the rails and then kill civilians. So unitary weapons as well, this is something that they do. And one of the problems we see with some of the airstrikes, just I'm sorry to harp on that, is when you've got a troops in contact situation, you don't always have the optimal weapon load. You are calling in the air that is closest to you. And that may be an aircraft with a 2,000-pound weapon that is going into a cave area, and you might not want to use that on a civilian spot, but if that's what you're going to use, if that's closest, that's what you're going to use. Now, as far as the depleted uranium, I know there's been a lot of talk about that in Iraq because you have a population that has lived for a long time now with DU ever since 91. There have been no long-term medical studies on that. It would be nice to see that happen in Iraq. I think that hasn't happened yet because of the security situation, because that is the population that's lived with it for the longest time now. In Afghanistan, I haven't heard a whole lot about DU at all.
Hi, my name is Rahila Zafar, and I recently came back from spending 2 years working in Afghanistan. And my question is for Elizabeth and Nader. Just from the time that you've also spent in Pakistan, did you get the sense that more and more Pakistanis are becoming sympathetic towards the Taliban because they are seeing more civilian casualties? And also, what impact do you think Afghan media can play in combating the manipulative messages of the Taliban?
Well, I will answer the first part. The second part, I'm not sure. When I was last in Pakistan in 2006 and actually was reporting on the Taliban in Pakistan, and in talking to people in Quetta and in Peshawar, which are the two bases for the Taliban in Pakistan, there was a lot of sympathy for the Taliban. And it had to do with so many different factors. Number one, it had to do with a Pashtun issue. It had to do with an anti-American issue. Certainly the civilian casualties, that what was NATO doing there but killing civilians, and that presumably they're hearing that not just from the news, though. They're hearing it because a lot of village Afghans live in Pakistan, and people are going back and forth across the border. And I did find a surprising amount of support amongst all sorts of people in those two provinces for the Taliban, less so in other areas. So I can't compare it with other times, but I would say definitely.
In terms of seeing an increasing number of suicide bombers that are coming from Pakistan, and some of them who just came and then introduced themselves to the security forces, that does not surprise that these civilian casualty as well as that the Taliban's very active propaganda and information dissemination in the tribal belt of Pakistan does affect there. Last year, beginning of last year, there was a young guy came to Kabul to conduct a suicide bombing, around 15 years old. he was told when he was sent to conduct that suicide bombing that there was no mosque left in Kabul. When he entered in Kabul and he heard the call for prayer, then he was like surprised how it happens. They told me that there's nothing, and then he went around and then he finds that it was untrue. Then he comes and introduced himself to police, and then the president got that information and called him, and his father was when he saw on the TV, so his father came, and the president pardoned him because he said he was not aware, he was not doing it intentionally, and he was brainwashed. So that was a good message to counterattack what's going on and brainwashing of the youngers in Pakistan, especially in the tribal belt. In the second question of how important role the media, the Afghan media, would play countering the Taliban's propaganda, it's very difficult because the Afghan media, it is one of the biggest achievements in the last few years, is the free media in Afghanistan. We have around 300 print media, 17 independent television, large number of TV stations, very provincial level and national level, radio stations. But they are trying to keep themselves neutral. So they don't want to allocate enough time on focusing against the Taliban. While there are now, which I'm personally not agree with, that NATO is putting a lot of TV spots and putting a lot of money into it to produce TV spots. And when it comes to the TV screen, like commercial ad, it comes after a commercial ad and says it's a part of commercial activity of the TV. And then with the logo of ISAF, the minute it comes, everybody turns the channel. So it reminds people of the Soviet time propaganda. And we keep telling NATO that you should not do it yourself this way. There are many other ways. Cover like a good story of the reconstruction and encourage the independent media to cover that as well. But at the same time, provide or sell you information on whatever happens, the real information, and that would that would help the journalists to do the balance. Provide balanced information. Recently, because the Taliban changed their tactic, on the ground battle they are not anymore that active, and because they saw that they are losing in terms of like Musa Qala and other places where they were organizedly fighting. Now they are trying to feed fear, and by doing this they're killing elders, they're assassinating leaders. Kidnapping an elder in Pakistan, bringing that person and killing in Afghanistan. That gives the Afghan media to talk about it, and that counters definitely the image the Taliban tries to build.
Let me just say a word about Pakistan, because I think it is important because of a debate that's going on right now. There have been a few dramatic civilian casualty incidents in Pakistan in the last 2 years. There was the Bajor bombing, which blew up a madrasa that may or may not have had some militants, but it certainly had a lot of people, up to 80 students, I think, who weren't militants, or at least were militants potentially in training, but were not engaged in military activity. There was another similar strike as well that had happened about 6 months prior to that. And there was, of course, also the Lal Masjid or Red Mosque incident in Islamabad, which was not a military strike from the air, but was rather a sort of Waco-like siege of what had become a very problematic madrasa, which may or may not have had weapons and militants in it as well, but again, there were a lot of people who were killed in that incident. This has caused enormous consternation. It has caused consternation at the extreme end in that it is used as a very effective militant recruiting tool. There's believed to be number of strikes, suicide bombings recently in Pakistan that have come directly from the Lal Masjid incident. But it's also raising a critical question for Pakistani and U.S. military strategy, because the NATO and U.S. forces are not in Pakistan in the way they are in Afghanistan. The way that they are engaging is through the use of predators. And there have been several predator strikes, one recently that supposedly took out the number three of Al-Qaeda. Although, if we had a nickel for every number three of Al-Qaeda who had been killed, I think there are only three positions in the organization, and you start at number three and move your way on up. The number three who was killed, that was deemed to be a relatively successful strike, I think, by many people, particularly in the U.S. government. And so there is a lot of consideration, particularly in this transitional phase for Pakistan, the extent to which they will continue to use strikes by unmanned drones on sites in Pakistan. And of course, when they go well and a few people are killed, including notable militants, maybe it doesn't raise concern, but then you have one bomb go badly, and it really, I think, can turn the nation against the entire concept of using military assets to fight against militants in Pakistan. So it's a very, topical question and debate right now.
It's like the military says, 100 attaboys and one aw shit equals one aw shit.
Yeah. Please.
Hi, Laura Eom. I'm a freelance reporter for 51%, which is a women's program. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the RAND Corporation study that was released at the end of last month, which is talking about the role of women in Afghanistan, and they were basically citing that along with other development reports to say that basically giving women an increased role in politics or establishing girls' schools and promoting women's rights helps to stabilize a country rather than destabilize a country. And they were giving an example of Afghanistan, but basically they were saying, in Afghanistan, there really isn't enough data to say that from the time of the Taliban, we can't really compare it, so there isn't enough data to say, yes, it's stabilized, but then on the other hand, you can't say that promoting it destabilized Afghanistan. So I'm wondering, did the role of women at all play any factor, you think, in what's happening in Afghanistan, and was it a positive role, or was it negative? Was it moving too quickly, perhaps, for Afghanistan society?
Well, it's very difficult, as you say. There's not a proper study specifically to measure that what effect that may it had. But certainly, it does not have any negative effect, or did not contribute to the insurgency or anger. And a good example would be in the areas where now it's difficult for women to have free movement or to be able, like in 2004 and 2005, to go to their offices in Kandahar, in Helmand, in southeastern part of the country, Paktia, Khost and Paktika. When we go there, both men and women, when we meet, we hear the same thing as we hear from a woman. We hear the same thing from the male member of those family. They say that the insecurity caused their family, and especially their women, to not participate again at their offices. They are not feeling comfort having their children, especially the girls, to go to far distance to attend the school because the Taliban issued threats that if your girl attends the school, we would kill, especially in those very disturbed areas in Helmand and some parts in Kandahar. And that gives you an indication that people do see that the improvement in the situation of women do affect to the overall situation of the society. If they see that their women can go easily to school or to attend the job, they consider that the situation is more normal, and they take it as a positive sign, which was 2004-2005.
I guess one other sort of completely unrelated question, but since I cover a lot of German issues. In Germany, you know, the German officials are very reluctant to put any troops into a combat role. And in Germany itself, it would be very unpopular if they were to do so. And I understand that at this point, the Social Democrats, it's possible that as part of their campaign platform next year, again, they're talking about withdrawing all of their troops out of Afghanistan. What effect will that have in Afghanistan if Germany, a key NATO partner, decides to pull its troops out?
I will just say that Human Rights Watch has been actively petitioning Germany and other NATO allies to become more involved in their security requirements and role on the ground in Afghanistan.
I want to just say that whenever there's a discussion at the capitals of either NATO or other international partners for withdrawal, majority of Afghans get very worried and concerned. And specifically now, there are when you look at the local media, they discuss if the war against terror and Afghanistan's destabilization requires the international community's friendship and puts the friendship at stake, then what expectation the people of Afghanistan may have from the international community? They question this partnership largely, but at the same time they show a large number of a high level of concern that if the international forces withdraw, if one of them starts withdrawing, then that would set a very negative precedence to the others. And especially the question comes to Germany, and then if they withdraw, it would directly affect the Dutch troops, it would directly affect the Canadians. And you can see the high level of concern, and people get worried whenever there's discussion about withdrawal.
I met recently with some German Social Democratic parliamentarians who are on the Defense Committee to talk about this issue. And the only thing that I would add, which is interesting, two things. First, they clearly felt that there was a German obligation to remain in Afghanistan, but felt that they were under enormous public pressure to change the engagement, which I thought was quite interesting. The other thing that was even more deeply fascinating on a philosophical level is that there appears to be a divergence in terms of attitudes towards the war on terror amongst some Europeans. And that is essentially, I think, like we saw maybe with the Spanish election, obviously this was a few years ago, not the recent one, that there are increasing number of people in Europe who feel that the threat in Europe comes from engagement in the Muslim world, not disengagement. In other words, they feel that leaving the problem alone and not having Western troops in the Islamic world will safeguard them against terrorist attacks as opposed to preventing them, which is obviously pretty much the exact opposite of the American view, and so I think an interesting issue to watch out for.
My name is Malal Nizam. I'm actually from Afghanistan. I'm an author and I'm a human rights activist, and especially my work is with the women and children abuse in Afghanistan. That's what I'm doing. I use a lot of Human Rights Watch reports. I rely on them a lot, on Amnesty International reports, United Nations reports, and the Human Rights Commission reports. That's what I'm usually working with. What I'm going to bring as a question or a comment both is that in Afghanistan there is not only a coalition war to bring peace for Afghan people, which is like Taliban, Al-Qaeda, so forth, with international forces. There are so many other things that I think are very important, that those things also have to come under the consideration. One of them are this drug trafficking. Al-Qaeda and Taliban, they are getting more powerful because a percentage of the drug traffic assets are coming to them. The other thing is that wherever their routes are, they are protecting each other, you know, with security also. Places like they're very, very, very popular, or they're very under this drug, production, are mainly those south and south west and southeast of Afghanistan. Helmand, Kandahar, places like that are the main areas. In these places, it's been after September 11, it's been so many forces, so many money, so many things, so many plans that went there, but the fields are only growing. To a person who is running a tank, it's not difficult to destroy a part of those fields and give to the a good plan to give to the farmer, the poor farmer, which gets only a little money to live through that effort that he puts in the fields for his family. That plan, which came with mainly with British plan, that they destroy the fields in those areas and protect the farmer with seeds and with at least 6 months ahead of time money to live, make a living or a minimum, you know, wage to live. That never happened. You know, they started to destroy the fields, but there was no protection for the former. So then the drug trafficker or the drug dealer came back and put them under pressure, and they went back because they didn't have anything to live with. So this is another thing that I'm sure the human rights watch groups are seeing it and noticing it. If in that part, I think, people, I mean, the countries or those who are helping Afghanistan put more effort, then the Taliban financially are not going that good. And we also get rid of that drug situation in Afghanistan slowly, gradually, whatever. The other thing I was going to say is that we all Afghan think that the number of troops, NATO or American or other countries, they are not enough for the situation of Afghanistan with not having any border to the south or to the east and sort of to the west. So for that situation, the number of troops that even your story brought it up is very, 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 very little to fight for that kind of spread out situation of Taliban, drug dealers, whoever. So is that...
Thanks for raising those issues. Any comments?
On the first issue, I would say that part of the problem is, in fact, I don't have the statistics, but a large proportion of the money that comes out of the drug trade goes into the hands of the government and not the Taliban. And the government doesn't... when I say the government, I don't mean officially, but I'm talking about ministers who are paid off, police at the checkposts who are under the control of a governor, the governor of provinces, the governor's brother in provinces, the president's brother. You know, I mean, this has a long trail of people who are involved.
The government.
He actually is in the government. He's in the head of the Provincial Council of Kandahar.
I'm from Kandahar. And
okay,
I
so
know
you know
him,
but he's the head of the provincial council, right?
I know, but the thing is that officially...
Anyway, let me just finish one thing, then you can respond. Right. But I'm just saying that, so there's a lot of interest not to stop this.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
It's not so easy just to say, okay, the British are going with a tank and, you know, destroy the crops and they should pay off the farmers. And there's such a vested interest amongst all of these people who are involved.
I believe it.
And the spoils are shared. So there has to be some huge program. I don't know what the answer is, but I don't think that the Taliban problem will suddenly go away with the drug problem going away.
No, but part.
Nader, do you want to comment? Sorry.
Just to add what Elizabeth said, I would fully agree with what you said in terms of there are, as a result of very poor governance and the involvement of a large number of those so-called officials into this business really affects in terms of any achievement and progress in poverty eradication. But at the same time, we shall not forget that an increasing areas under control of Taliban, an increase in those areas into the production of poppy, is an indication of Taliban's direct involvement into the drug business.
Sure, they're encouraging.
They are encouraging. Right. And we had stories had people who coming to us from Helmand. They were telling us that in the areas where we support the government and we are pro-government, the government forces comes and they just destroy our fields while we don't we are not provided with any other alternative, not only seed. They don't look only about seed. Some places they have seeds, but where they sell it, they don't have the market for it.
Yeah.
So they look at the alternative livelihoods there. But they say, the Taliban continuously encourages us and sends us message. They say, what you do, you just let us come in and we will protect your poppy field. And the government would not come. And they were saying that it's not logic where the areas they can't go, the government can't go to destroy, they are easily growing. And the areas we're supporting the government, they come and destroy us without providing alternatives. So I would say, as much as the some so-called officials are getting benefit from this drug trafficking. The same amount goes to the Taliban. The poor farmers, I would agree with
and
you.
And the warlords.
The poor farmers are totally left out. They are the main, between the two rock. Mm. They're pushed from the two sides. They're not getting it. Mm.
And the warlords, you know.
Thanks. We have a couple more questions, yeah.
My name is Carl Osgood. I write for Executive Intelligence Review. I'd sort of like to get back to the civilian casualty problem here that you've all described and ask what is actually the strategic effect of waging the war the way Mark has described. Are we increasing support for the Taliban? Are we dragging out the war this way? And secondly, if more troops on the ground would solve this problem, where are these troops going to come from, since Europe seems to be unwilling to provide them and the U.S. has practically run out of troops?
Well, one of the strategic effects that you have is what we saw after the attacks in Kapisa province, in which you had back-to-back incidents where there was a ground attack when the Marines drove through and there were a number of civilians killed, and then the next day there was an airstrike and 9 civilians were killed when 2 GBU-31s hit a home. And so then, the very next day, you have these massive rallies against the government. And while we just said, you know, there are large parts of the government that are certainly corrupt, it is a democratically elected government, and the option is the return of the Taliban, which would, in all likelihood, bring back massive human rights problems. No one wants that. What's the easy answer? I don't know. There is a strategic effect. I mean, when I was at NATO last year, right after I got back from Afghanistan, I went and spoke to them. I said, the one thing that you guys have to do more than anything else is take more tactical risks in order to win the strategic battle. And by and large, that was the one message of all the messages I gave them that they came afterward and said, you know, that's an area where you're absolutely correct. We need to take bigger tactical risks. And they started to do that. Now, they can take greater tactical risks without an increase in forces on the ground. But in my most humble opinion, at some point, I think the realization has to be that, you know, you can't just replace boots on the ground with bombs on target. You know, there has to be some kind of a change that goes on there.
Just to add on this, it's not only the question of more boots on the ground. There are some issues that need to be done and would help in reduce of the people's anger and people's frustration towards situation. If people see that their life is going to change, they have road, they have school, and at the same time they see good faces running their offices as a governor, as a district governor, as chiefs of police, that would enormously affect the way people would look to the government and to the international community. So far, the focus has been only to win this battle militarily, mm-hmm. and that's gonna not work in the long term. As you say, that there's not going to be a long-term commitment in terms of more troops. The reality is that the governments in different capitals, they are struggling with their parliaments and public opinion to keep those troops there. But we say the time that Afghans has is very short. Certainly the alternative is not Taliban. People do not like them, and it would be a nightmare for them if they see they're coming. And the signs are coming. In the last year, the level of fear was very much that the Taliban would come. The government is so weak, it would collapse. The international community would pull out. Even among very committed civil society activists and a large number of Afghans, they were discussing where to go next. Pakistan would not allow them to come in. Iran would not take them anymore as a refugee, where they should go. And this level of fear, you could see that Taliban is not at all an alternative for people. So the alternative is not more military only. Of course, we need that for a while. More of investment on Afghan National Army. They have somehow built some sort of reputation. People do trust them somehow. And in large number of operations where they were together with the international forces, the results were good. They were respectful of the cultural sensitivities and lots of other issues. More investment on the reform of national police, I would call even transformation of the Afghan national police. Not only more bikes and motors or good uniforms, but at least the training, the behavior and all of that need to be changed in order to buy confidence and trust of the population. And third, of course, reform throughout the government. the CRAP, the transitional justice, as was raised several times, is one of the key. And people at this stage, they're very realistic. They don't want to put everybody on trial. They say, just get rid of them, just marginalize these bad guys, change the face of government, put good people. And that would affect in buying more confidence.
Let me just jump on that real quick. You know, I just want to say that the airstrikes issue has almost become a red herring, to the point where what's really important are your non-kinetic options, and that's where your investment needs to be.
The only thing I would add to what Nader said is just that in the region where I was, down from that valley in the Pech River, where the military had actually built a long road. I think it was, I don't know, they invested $12 million or something in it. It really has changed everyone's life. And you actually have village elders debating about whether or not they were going to support the insurgents anymore, who were going to start attacking another road project, because they saw what would happen with, in other words, women could get to the hospital. That was a huge thing. Women could get to the hospital and deliver children and in a quarter of the time. The markets were moved, markets were opened up along the road. It really did change people's lives, and they started not to want to support the Taliban in their next, because there was another road coming, and there were arguments with the Taliban about whether to lay IEDs and to attack the road workers there. So it has a huge effect when the investment goes into, as they were saying, into non-military.
Let me ask a follow-up question that we were discussing the other day. These bombs are quite expensive, as well as the airplanes that fly them.
The bombs are actually not that expensive. I think that's not correct. Bombs
no.
Aren't that expensive.
Do you know how much are they?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I'll just take a guess at, you know, and if you've got a JDAM with a JDAM package on it, I don't know, maybe around 20-30 grand.
Okay, so if you're dropping 80,000 pounds on average a month.
Yeah, they dropped 600,000 pounds in 2006, and they dropped 1,200,000 pounds in 2007.
And how much does that cost?
A lot of money.
Work it out. Compared to the U.S. military budget, it's really not.
Okay, but that's not what I'm comparing to. What I'm comparing to, the question is.
I mean, I'm comparing it to like a Tomahawk land attack missile, which is $1 million a pop.
Compared to the civilian project.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's not even the question. The question is, could we be spending the bomb money to pay
army.
People off. No. Forget
the
army.
The
in
Taliban.
The near term. Could we
bomb supply
ships? Not in the Taliban, the villages. I mean, could we be spending significant amounts of, which is something that they've been doing in Iraq in the last year and a half, is actually giving money to villagers and tribal leaders through whatever mechanism that basically buying them off.
We won't drop bombs, we'll give you money.
I would not encourage buying the elders, because this as certainly we Afghans had very, very bad experience with that. Some guys like Dostum and others are a result of this buying them, and now they are buying everything in the country and running the drug and most of the other stuff. But I would definitely encourage and say that the total amount of this war, only the military operations, cost something to all countries, something around $100 billion, something. And if $20 billion of that was invested properly in building factories, in building infrastructures, we would not have the Taliban. There was a survey, I think, was conducted by the former Minister of Finance, Ashraf Ghani, and was going around and asking people how you define a Talib. And his finding shows that a Talib is defined by the community, by the people, is the young, unemployed man who has seen no change in his life. So if you have $20 billion invested in infrastructure and factories and job creations and irrigation system and electricity, in 5 years, I would not say that certainly the Taliban and insurgency would have stopped fully, but there was very, very limited space for it.
That's a larger policy question I completely agree with, that you need to, dare we say, put more money into the State Department and those types of projects. But it comes down to a decision on how you actually wage the war, how you fight it. And, you know, just saying, oh, bombs cost this much money, let's transform bombs into plowshares, I think that's just a little too simplistic. There needs to be a larger, you know, investment into those non-kinetic options.
Okay, our last question.
Hi, I'm Jeff Bernstein from the Henry L. Stimson Center. First of all, thank you to everyone for presenting your very unique perspectives on this issue. I guess my question is directly linked to the last couple questions. A couple weeks ago, NATO Secretary General Schäfer, in remarks here actually in Washington, he commented that our active engagement, our military engagement in Afghanistan, just as in Iraq or anywhere else, has to be directly and inextricably linked to our reconstruction efforts in the country. And I think we all understand that and agree with that statement. My question, and Nader, you kind of you started to refer to this in your remarks, but whether it's a troop contributing country or it's development workers, wherever this aid is coming from, is there a way, I guess, that we can try and protect both the workers and civilians from the Taliban or Al Qaeda attacking these people and these areas that are being worked on and having money contributed to as visible targets? Essentially, is there anything that can be done to prevent a soldier good-naturedly trying to help someone either with medical aid, something like this, from being blown up?
I think there are two different ways so far, as we've seen. One is this project, National Solidarity Program, which is driven by the community itself, which is decided by the village elders at the very remote villages. And once they decide how to spend that portion of money or the package that is allocated for them by the central government or by the government, then they, when they make out of that money a project, either a school or bridge or whatever, then they are the one to protect it. And there are many cases. Recently, last year, we had around 300 schools were set into fire, especially in the south of the country, by the Taliban elements. And this was a major concern, that if you do the reconstruction work, then what happens? And again, they come and set them into fire. The ministry has initiated a different way of community protection for these schools. In some incident, the Taliban were even shooting to the children who were attending. A number of teachers were beheaded or killed in front of the children of the school. Now this community initiative, because people themselves feel ownership of these projects and these buildings, so they are protecting. And in the last 4 months, I would say there is not a single incident where a school to be set into fire, because the community themselves feel that it is belong to them. They were involved in the decision making and into the protection. The question is now, if we channel the money to the government, how much capacity and how much protection for the misuse we have within, or the mechanism for transparency and prevention of the misuse of those funds. Then that again goes to the question of good governance, committed people, and all of that. But the PRTs, who are doing very good job in different parts, even the military with the military uniform in the areas where they are involved, we see a very limited number of, even in Nuristan, in Konar, there are a large number of PRT projects. And we see that the decrease in the level of insurgency and attacks there, even by the military. In the areas, however, to be realistic, in Helmand and even in Nimrud, in the highway that is repathed or path from Nimrud, that is the middle of desert, the Taliban, and especially it's very politically targeted, motivated, because people say it's an Indian company and people just come for that target crossing the border to hit it. And it's obvious, and protection of that requires more attention.
Any final comments from either of you?
I'll just close by saying that clearly we've seen violations of the Geneva Convention across the board by the Taliban. Forced labor, murder, maiming civilians, some pretty awful stuff going on. We've seen, not violations of IHL by NATO and the U.S. and the airstrikes, some questionable activity, but a concerted effort to change. And that's heartening. Of course, we're very concerned about the spring offensive, and so we're going to be really pushing hard to try to get that message out to them in the near future.
The only thing I would add is that turning over slowly. You know, everyone talks about how to get more troops, and it's possibly not the answer. Turning over the problem to the Afghan army, which unfortunately the way that the system is set up now, the Afghan National Army is really consistently kept on training wheels. They don't have enough ammunition. They don't have enough weapons. They don't have enough helicopters. They don't have enough food. They don't have enough water. They don't have enough clothes. You know, you see them in comparison with the NATO soldiers, and they're not very aggressive. They tend to sort of stay back. If they're in an engagement, they will fire because they're defending themselves, but they're never going to take an initiative because they don't have to and because they don't have the resources that NATO has. And so they're kept constantly in a kind of kindergarten. And until they're sort of let, I just think so much more money needs to be put into the Afghan army and to really make it into a serious force that can take on this problem as, you know, even making up for the lack of NATO troops. But it's going to take time, but I think that is one of the great things that we could contribute.
Well, I want to thank our speakers for a really interesting and engaging session, and especially thank all of you for making it out today to this session of the U.S. Institute of Peace's Afghanistan Working Group. Thank you.